When looking for a gallery that's a little unusual, that's a little odd, sometimes you really have to peek around. You have to keep driving, keep finding, and then suddenly something catches you by surprise. Happened to me in an antique mall, and it may not be right here, but it definitely has an address on Sideways Boulevard. I'm Mark L. Groves, Shelby Dollar, and J.E. Peterson weren't able to make it here tonight. I love going to antique malls. Quite honestly, I love looking for pictures, photos of people, because so many of them have odd looks. You'll find something and go, oh my God, what the hell's going on in this thing? And it's intriguing and it's a story. And since I'm a writer, I love to write, and these things can start stories in my head. I also love weird mugs. I wish I'd kept it. I gave it to my son, and afterwards I'm like, oh, I should have kept it. It was like a 1953 Sigma Hudawada fraternity mug, but it had the guy's name on it. And in 1953, this was no big deal, because in great big kind of Greco-Roman letters, it said Dick. And I'm like, this is awesome. All right, so that's why I was there. Okay, so I go walking down an aisle in the Metcalf Antique Mall. And what do I stumble upon but booth 1313? And I was delighted. And lucky for me, the artist at this booth, who not only had the art in the booth, but made the frigging booth, is a gentleman by the name of John Kelly. And John Kelly joins us here on Sideways Boulevard. Welcome, John.
Hey, Mark. Thank you very much.
We chatted up a storm that day. It was awfully fun because I felt extremely rude. One, ignoring my wife, who was also walking around like, oh, baby, I got to talk to this guy. And she's like, do your thing. You do you. And then second, you had customers coming up and I'm like, oh my God, I'm totally, money blocking this guy.
Oh no, no, no.
So, we chatted, we found that we had quite a bit of common ground.
Yes.
When it comes to what we're going to call here, there's probably a really cool name for it, but I don't know what it is. Noir art, dark art.
Yes. Dark art.
Art that draws you, but has a look and tone that, is not, you know, your everyday sofa art. Thank God.
Yes.
And by the way, just to give them a shout out, Metcalf Antique Malls at 9148 Metcalf Avenue in Overland Park, Kansas. If you're in Kansas City, stop by. It's a cool place. On Saturdays, they frequently have a jazz group playing in this mall. Yeah. And it's good jazz. It's not elevator jazz. These guys get into it. And I'm like, oh my God, I could shop here forever. Well played, Metcalf Antique. You got me. Regency Park Shopping Center. They're open Monday through Saturday, 10 to 8, Sunday, 10 to 6. All right, John, before we get into your artwork and the things that you do and some of the ways that you've come about it, let's talk a little bit about your background, which, by the way, you will not find online, because I'll be damned if you can find anything about John Kelly. We're going to talk about Secret Agent Man here, but tell us a little bit about your background. Like, okay, where'd you grow up? Are you a Kansas City native?
Yes, yes. I've always lived in Kansas City and was born in Kansas City, Kansas, in Wyandotte County.
Oh, the KCK.
Oh, yeah.
Sweet.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I have spent most of my life, though, in Missouri.
Oh.
So once I graduated, did a little college and moved to Missouri.
Which college you go to?
I went to Kansas City, Kansas Community College.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Okay, because I've actually taught at and I got a certificate from the Johnson County Community College.
Oh, cool.
A digital marketing certificate with a minor in what the hell is this? But, I am still learning.
It's a good minor.
Yeah, it's drinking from a fire hose. So you went to, when you went to college, did you go for a degree in art or?
No, it was mainly just to like self-improvement courses. My parents always tried to get me interested. They weren't pushy about trying to set my career or anything like that, but they were very supportive. Always knew I loved art. I have an older brother who's 2 years older than I am, and we're day and night. He likes hunting, and when we were kids, he always had the army men, the BB guns, things like that.
So let me guess, was he kind of like, now, older brother?
Yes, two years old.
The alpha male type brother?
Yes, we find common ground. We talk Bigfoot and things like that.
Oh,
we
love that stuff. So does he know what Bigfoot tastes like since he's a hunter?
Yes, exactly. But my parents, they always knew when we were children that John got the art supplies and Donald got the BB guns and things that dealt with that.
Yeah.
And I was probably a mystery to my parents. I always had a morbid fascination. And my artwork usually reflected that, even as an early age, as a child. And
Did they ever sit you down and kind of feel you up about it?
Yes.
Honey, are you all right?
Yes. Yes.
You know, I noticed that you're kind of into some.
It sounds like
things.
That happened to you too, Mark.
It might have, John. Yeah. It might have.
Yeah. So the college thing, backing up a second here, my parents always reinforcing the art and everything, even though they didn't understand all of it.
Yeah.
They knew that when I was interested in taking some college courses, they threw in there, now take an advertising art course, because they always wished that I would get involved with Hallmark and have the stability, the 9-to-5, the insurance, all that type of stuff.
Oh, that is sweet.
And yeah, they were looking out.
They were
for
trying.
Me.
Yeah,
they were trying.
God bless them.
But what happened? I got in there. I did one semester of advertising and found out it's too structured. I'm one of those artists that the creative muse is completely in control. So,
right.
Yeah. I can't. Deadlines are hard for me. I don't do consignments. I tried doing that when I first started showing my art in my early 30s. But it's too structured. And I could probably make a lot more money if I could just do things people hand me and get them done. But it just doesn't work that way. It's not anything but when the creative muse is there, it works. And when it isn't, it's not happening. So when those courses came alongside the advertising art, I realized that I had an interest in architecture because I had taken some theater in high school.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so early American art history appealed to me because we studied early American architecture, which was the earliest art form. And so that was in part of the course.
Well, define early American architecture, because I'm caught between log cabins and Corinthian columns.
Yeah.
I don't know where
exactly.
This lands.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, does it cover it all?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, God.
I mean,
okay.
You know, what came from Europe, you know, Gothic architecture, which is obviously my favorite. But, we learned about half timber homes, settler homes, things like that.
I was about to say, did you go over the structure of a nice sod house I got here in the prairie? Hey,
yes.
look at my hole. This is a fancy hole I got here.
exactly. So it started off with that and then got into some artists and things. And it was an enjoyable course. And I took drawing one and things like that. It was just for self-improvement. But
So how did that parlay into a supporting career? What do you currently do to actually put food on the table? And then, you know, you do your art for that burning ache, that need that comes along.
Of course.
But, you know, how do you feed the gut?
Well, let me back up a second here on, it was during high school when, I started going to auditions for different theater and like Worlds of Fun and places like that, because I had that theater interest. So I wanted dancing and singing, acting, things like that. But also set building was an interest of mine, just any kind of stagecraft. So I thought that was the route I was going to go after high school and was trying to prepare for that. Well, one day my father was waiting up for me.
Uh-oh.
And, not waiting up. It was like in the afternoon, whatever. But he was waiting for me, and I was still living at home. And before I took the college courses, like I said, I was still in high school, but he had that talk with me. He wanted me to get serious about a career, think about the phone company, gas company, something like that and stuff. And I let him say everything he needed to say. And I said, Dad, you just watch. I will make a career out of doing what I love to do. I love this kind of stuff. And don't worry about me.
Oh.
Well, later in years, after college, I got involved in teaching dance, ballroom dancing, of all things.
Oh, dude, that's how my wife and I met. But
there you go.
That's for a whole different story.
How funny. I knew we were kindred.
Yeah, there was something going on, man. There's too many.
It's weird.
You know, you're talking about being a thespian. I've got Finian's Rainbow on the turntable there. Because I was like, Jesus Christ, when was I? I was in this 42 years ago, and in high school, and then the next year was Oklahoma.
Yeah,
and,
You know, all the musicals.
And then doing stagecraft. I wasn't so much about doing stagecraft, but God, I love doing the audio for it. I'm going to toot my own horn a little, and then we're going to talk about
it.
John again.
No, I love
because he's the guest, and I'm not. People are used to me yakking my ass off.
I love this parallel.
But down in Dallas, Texas, there's a wonderful theater called Pegasus Theater.
Yeah.
That I got to get involved in doing some volunteering, and they were like, "Oh, you actually know how to do some shit? Okay." And God bless them, Mr. Klein and Barb. They allowed me to I helped with one show doing building stages. I was in two of them as an actor, and then I got to do sound design. And getting to the point, the sound design and working there, it was a tiny, tiny little booth and, you know, basically a pretty simple mixer board. But I got to actually design the audio. Wow. And it was for a play called One of Them Male Things. My work got nominated for a Leon Raben Award, Dallas Theater League Award. And I didn't go to the banquet. I didn't do anything. Like, and now I look back and go, holy cow, that was actually pretty cool, you moron.
Yeah, right.
But being, you know, working behind the stage with theater, and even up here, I wrote a play that got done at the Just Off Broadway Theater. This whole thing about theater and the energy.
Yeah.
A theater and theater people. They're bug nuts crazy.
Yes.
And that's part of the charm.
That's part of it. Yeah, exactly.
So you started working in some theaters and you told your dad, I'm going to make this work.
Yeah.
And you proved it.
Yeah. Well, I kept trying different auditions, things. I wasn't finding my little niche. Yeah. I kept not getting callbacks and stuff.
But
I didn't get completely discouraged. So I got hooked up with this dance studio and met someone through one of the other instructors who has some venues here in town, from dance clubs to restaurants, whatever he puts on, he's always successful. And
what's
what
his
he
name?
Does. His, we'll call him Woody.
Oh, okay.
Because I don't know if he hates name dropping.
We'll
call him Woody. But anyway, great friend of mine. I met him through the studio, and he liked some of the stuff I was choreographing stuff, and he invited me over to one of his dance clubs. He was doing a little stage show there, like a variety show.
Yeah.
And it was just kind of a one-man show. And then he said, just jump on stage, do your thing, show us, you know, this and that in between some songs. And I got to request whatever song. And he found out I did stage sets and things like that. So he hired me on full time.
Oh, my God.
I quit my job at the bank. And I worked for
him. Were working at a bank at the time.
I was working at the bank at the time at the same between college. And he hired me on full time, and I worked for him for 36 years.
Now. Oh, my Lord. That's fantastic.
Designing stage sets for him, designing interiors like the restaurant. The most recent is the Reef up north by KCI. It's like you're eating underwater. It's really a beautiful restaurant, and I got to help create that.
Oh, my
gosh. So I learned to work with different materials and sharpen my skills with things like that. But I love thematic things,
mm-hmm.
stuff like that. So it all plays into getting to this booth, and from a child loving old horror films, black and white films.
Okay.
To,
when did you first discover that you really like the kind of the darker, spookier side of stuff? What's your first memories of going, oh, I really dig that, and realizing, hey, I like the dark stuff.
Yeah. I don't, you know, I think it's a combination of things because, on the morbid side of it, my interest in death and things like that. I remember my first funeral I went to was my great grandfather on my dad's side, his grandfather. And I can't remember what age I was, very young. And my parents really wasn't trying to shield me completely from it then. But then later on, I think they became concerned because I developed a fascination, it seemed like, after that funeral. But I remember certain things about it, how it was set and everything. It was like a different world to me. And it was a little bit of special effects going on and very theatrical. I see funerals as very theatrical because you have a foreground, you have a middle ground, you have a background, the placement of the flowers, there's a star involved, there's a person, guest of honor there, as we say.
Under the spotlight, so to speak.
Yeah, and so everything's beautifully
with great makeup.
Placed. Yeah, exactly. It's very it's very theatrical. And so that kind of stuck. And then watching these horror films and death being involved in those, and a lot of it was tombs and cemeteries things like that. It fit my world. I was comfortable and happy and you know, diving into trying to create these things and miniatures and things like that. It all connected with the theater and the whole special effects things. I love creating corpses and things like that too, which you'll see, Mark, probably coming up this spring in my booth, one of the corpses I made.
Full size a scale? Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, really?
And a toe pincher, that I made. And so everything, it all stems from all of that. And I'm, like I said, very thematic and stuff. And so I love creating that world. It's fun. And taking people into that journey of darker things and stuff. It's fun.
Well, your first toe dip into it is much more meaningful than mine. For me, it was just Dark Shadows.
Oh, Dark Shadows.
1968.
Oh, my gosh.
I still remember being a 4-year-old. Oh, it scared the hell out of me.
Yeah.
And I like the wolf guy, although Barnabas Collins was interesting, but the wolf man was my dude.
Yes.
Except he still scared me.
Same
and I
here.
Still remember mom and dad going, go to bed. You know, you watch this, you're going to have nightmares. And I would. I became scared of the dark. But I snuck back in, and I remember being behind the couch and just kind of raising up both mom and dad. I'm right at the back of their heads. They don't even know I'm there. Well, my dad, that was pretty much his modus operandi. But as they're watching the show, I'm just eyes just above the couch, checking out Barnabas Collins sneaking while there's all these clouds going. So, from an early age on, and you experienced it in a much more realistic fashion, but yet it sparked a much larger picture of it when it there was the fascination with all the things that went around it.
Yeah.
And you're so right that there is a pageantry to it, to a funeral.
Yeah.
And you know what? I've got all these other questions, but we're going to skip right into it. 'Cause you and I had a fun discussion about it. Let's talk about death.
Yeah.
And the fact that, would you say that nowadays we still treat it as intimately as 100 years ago? Or would you say that that people have really changed in the way that they feel about death?
It definitely has changed. I mean, even since I was a young man and up until 9, it's gone through a transition. I'm very traditionalist when it comes to funerals and things like that. I love the what would it be called? I can't think of the word for it. Where very formal, where
really traditional funeral styles and funeral rites.
Yes, yes. There's a respect about it, I think, and stuff. And everyone's got to be comfortable with how they say their goodbye, you know, loved one and everything. So I'm not saying there's anything wrong with how some people want to deal with death today and how they say their goodbye. But back when, there was a formality and there was a respect, and you know, you didn't wear jeans to a funeral. You didn't wear, you know, a bib overalls and a ball cap. You know, it seemed more official. It went deeper into that respect and everything. And there were things about, like in Victorian time, where things were done even after death, where they would cover the mirrors. And things like that, which I find very fascinating. It's part of that morbid fascination. And again, it's very theatrical. Women wore black for years, and gentlemen wore black bands and things on their arms and their suits and stuff. That mourning continued, even though life went on. There was this deep respect and to honor that life on and on. Now it's changed a bit, jumping completely to now from that. There's this thing called celebration of life. A lot of times funerals are called that. And like we were talking about, Mark, sometimes the guest of honor isn't even there.
Isn't even,
in any form, ashes or anything.
There might be a picture, but if you're talking about any type of physical remains or physicality of them,
I think it's easier. A lot of times I think things are skipped because it's taboo. It's hard to talk about death, and especially to children and everything. And that's why I always love the fact that my parents let me have so many pets and everything, because pets teach us about death. Of course, we outlive them and stuff. And so it's easier for someone like myself who's had a lot of pets, you know, even though there's that tearful moment and mourning and sense of loss and stuff like that, I think in a sense I'm more equipped to handle it. Like when I lost my parents, both my parents in the same year of cancer, it was easier for me than my brother. Because I could, in a sense, in my fascination of being morbid, things like morbid things, I embrace it, you know, and I even see humor in it a little bit and stuff. And so I'm not dying every day trying to avoid it or something like that. If we embrace it and can see the beauty in it, just as birth is just as beautiful as death and vice versa, it's easier. I think a lot of times we ice it over. I think some people do because they don't even want to see a hearse. They don't want to experience, you know, an open casket. Sometimes it's easier to have that closure where, like, it's just sent away.
It is hard to face that. And I think, like, funerals, in my opinion, are so much for the living. Mm-hmm. They are for the living. And
exactly.
I love the connection that you have with them in the sense of the respect that you do for the person who was passed, or even if you don't have an inkling who the hell the person was, but it was, you know, your buddy's best uncle that he loved dearly, and you go for your buddy, you're there to pay respect to your buddy and to say, you know, I love you, man.
Yeah.
And I'm here for you. I don't D about the dead.
Right.
But I know you.
Yes.
And I'm here for you.
Yeah.
And
it's
I've had
part of that respect too. Yeah,
I've had definitely. Friends do that, like when my dad passed, when my mom passed, etc. So I completely appreciate that. The I think a lot of people avoid it so hard, not just because, oh my God, this person I loved, cared for, cherished has passed. But so often it is, and we've talked about that, it's the existential slap.
Right.
It's that point in your frickin' life when you suddenly realize, holy shit, I'm going to die.
Right.
I really am going to die. It's not just a someday I'm going to die. It's not some romantic thing. You're busy reading Sylvia Plath and moaning about, you know, whatever tragedy you think you've been through. No, you suddenly realize, oh shit.
Right.
This is really good. And it's going to be sooner than later.
It's a reality check. And also, depending on how we say our goodbyes and stuff to get that closure. Because grieving is a healthy part of letting go and things like that of our loved ones. It's part of that process and everything. And if we kind of ice it over, we're not doing ourselves a favor. We're sort of disguising it, like I said, icing it over to where it doesn't hurt as bad if we don't have to see them. But I don't know if it was you the other day. I got in the conversation.
Did it sound
about
smart?
Animals. Yeah,
then it was.
And
me.
It came from you.
Dude, I was totally kidding. I was trying to be a smartass.
Yeah.
Oh, cool. Well, let it rip. What brilliant thing did I say to you, John?
No, I think we were in the conversation about animals. And we were talking about wolves. I think I saw something on PBS where one of the members of the pack had died.
Yeah.
And the other wolves were circling it. And one by one, they would go up and sniff it and everything. And they would leave one by one and rejoin. And years ago, just like the bank job, I always had like these side jobs. Of course, you're a starving artist at first. But anyway.
Gotta suffer.
We gotta suffer. But I worked for a veterinarian in Parkville. And as a veterinarian assistant, because of my love of animals and everything, I enjoyed that work.
Yeah.
And gotten conversations with the doctor about such things. And she said that it's healthy, as morbid as it sounds, like if you're having your beloved pet put down,
yeah,
to actually, because she always asked them if they wanted to take the remains home. If you have other pets, if you have other dogs, say you were putting down one dog, it's actually healthy for the other pets to see the deceased. Because otherwise, they have no idea. One day they're there, the next day they're gone.
Yeah.
So there's no closure for that pet. And they suffer a bit for it because they're disoriented. They don't know what's happened or what will happen to them. And I think it works that way for a lot of people like myself. When that guest of honor is there, it's sort of your way of closing that up. It all depends on the individual. So if you can make your plans before it gets to that point, because we don't know how quick or what's going to happen to us, what our final end is or what it's going to look like. I think that's what we most fear, if there's that fear about death. But if someone wants not to be there as a guest of honor in a celebration of life, then that's the right thing.
Yeah.
If they know it's going to comfort other people in the family or friends and stuff like that, those things should be talked about though.
Yeah.
You know, it shouldn't be, not talked about and be a taboo subject and things like that.
Well, I won't kid you. There's a little tiny treasure chest on one of my shelves in my office.
Oh, yeah.
That has a little bit of my brother's ashes in it.
There you go.
And bro will always be with me. And
there you go. That's your comfort.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. When I finally slide into the oven of evermore and come out as sneeze powder.
Yeah.
I'm hoping they'll mix a little bit of my brother in there and then put me wherever. I don't care. Put me in a forest, etc. All right. So you cannot miss your booth. You round a corner and you're like, this one's different.
Yes.
Tell us about your booth. Booth 1313 at Metcalf Antique Mall.
Well, thanks, Mark. I'm so glad you love it and you totally get it and everything. And most everybody, of course, I get a kick out of seeing people's first reaction. It makes me feel proud of what I created and stuff. It's just a little corner of the world. And I treat it like my 9-to-5. And how I got the booth in the first place, I have a friend who was getting a booth there. And he had told the owner that I do dark art. And so he came to me and said, you know what? You'd do really well if you put in a dark art booth here. And I was like, really? Here on Metcalf? I just couldn't see in an antique mall. And even though, some of my frames I resalvaged, they can be antiques, vintage, whatever. But I was like, an artist in here. I always wanted my own little art gallery or something like that. But I never thought of placing it in an antique mall. And he said, trust me. And so I took the chance and he proved me wrong. Yeah. I've been doing better there than any art gallery or pop-up shows I've done, street shows. It's because of the different people you run into and people who don't even think about dark art. But what was fun in creating that, I started drawing there as I was building my booth in the back room. We've got a storeroom there. And he let me use some space back there and got a handful of foam material I used before in creating.
Now, when you say foam, is that styrofoam or foam rubber?
No, it is styrene, a white insulation board, 4x8 sheets. And you can get it different thicknesses. And so I got a few sheets and took my measurements for the booth I was going to go into, which is the one now, and started carving away. I used a bread knife for sawing and a paring knife for doing the detail, cracks and things like that.
Sexy art guy tools.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nice.
I don't like using hot wire. I've tried that and I don't seem to have as much control. So, to reflect my dark art, which can be considered gothic art also, I thought the best thing to create for this booth would give it an atmosphere of gothic ruins. And that's how that look became. That's the base of it.
There is up along the top of it, you've painted, it looks like the walls are all black. Mm-hmm. And then up along the top is this, it looks like stonework.
Yeah.
And, you know, cathedral stonework, but yet it's styrene. And it's just so cool because that descends down and then kind of describe, let's talk about your art now. Okay. And you have prints that are there. I don't think there's anything that's the original.
Mm-hmm.
Work. Yes. Oh, there is?
Yeah.
Oh, do tell.
I sell talk originals also. And I've sold a handful already since September that I've actually created there in the booth. I'll set up my easel and draw there. Like I said, I'll use it like my little studio and 9 to 5. And what's fun is when you're drawing there too, it brings up conversation with people passing by, and they want to know what you're drawing, what are you doing, what kind of material you're using, what, and then that leads to the conversation of, well, I don't just stick with charcoal pastels. I work with foam. I work with concrete, metal, acrylic, anything I get my hands on. And through those conversations, it brings more worth to the work because not only are they meeting the artist, but they're finding out what goes in behind that. And specifically with the dark art, they want to know, well, why are you so into the dark art and creating things of shadows and things like that? And
what's your answer?
Well, it depends on who you're talking to a lot of times, because I can kind of tell sometimes they're searching for something different, but
they have a knife in one hand and a Bible in the other going, right. What is it?
I got it. You know, you got a tippy toe a little bit, but no, all of them really been great conversations. And I tell them because simply, like I told my father, when he was asking, why do you draw such dark things? Because I see beauty in it.
Yeah.
Because there's something that brings to my eye, something in creating it that brings me joy. And if that's in my DNA, or is it something I picked up through my morbid fat? I don't know. Or is it cause of it? Is that something my creative muse makes for me?
Yeah.
Because all I know is it makes me happy. And when I see people interested, especially young people that haven't thought about such art or something like that, you know, in that realm, they their questions are genuine and they want to know, what is it? Why do you tick this way? And stuff. Yeah. And it's a lot of fun raising those conversations and talking about death and things that we were just talking about. It's all connected to that. From the monster movies to funerals to visiting cemeteries and enjoying the architecture of the uprights and everything, it all seemed to make sense to me because it was all connected. And yeah, And before you know it, you know, someone's walking out with one of my pieces.
Hallelujah and amen.
It feels so good because they got a new appreciation too. And yeah.
Being able to talk to people about your process and your work, your mm-hmm. art, is surprising, especially in this type of context. Because we talked about that actually the first time we met.
Yeah.
When you had chatted about how you're, you actually get such a better response in, this is mm-hmm. an antique mall.
Yeah.
I mean, surprising. Just down the way, we've got some Avon bottles and some really nice yes. French Provençal tables.
Exactly.
And then we've got this dark art that's working and selling.
Yeah.
I had a similar experience. There's a place called the Sugar Mound Arts and Crafts Festival that's south of here in, Mound, Kansas. And it's a pretty busy weekend for a little bitty place like that. Tiny, tiny town, you know, you blink, oh, you missed yeah. it. But they have this little kind of fairgrounds area down there. And then they bring in about 10, 15, 20,000 people wow. in a weekend.
That's
and
amazing.
I had never done one of these. I was going and selling, you know, the books that J.E. and Shelby, who you haven't met, are in several of the books that I've put out. And I thought, it's pretty cheap to go there for the whole weekend. I can take my little 10x10 yeah, pop up. Sure. And, you know, what the heck? I had a little bit of stock left. It was, you know, first or second weekend in October. I'm like, I'll give it a try, see what happens. And so I went there with no expectations and I sold every frickin' book I had wow. but one. I was good out of stock. You. I wow. would have sold more wow. if I'd had more. I had one last something? Copy left of Hell's a Palooza and yeah. that was it. And I'm like, what the
in
hell just happened?
Yeah. It's amazing.
And it's yeah. all these nice people walking up and yeah. it was grandmother's buying. Oh, my grandson would just love something like that. Yeah. Hell yeah. What's his name? I'll sign it. I'm on this.
Yeah.
And for several years I went there and it was so surprising. There are people that you wouldn't expect that enjoy that see the beauty.
Mm-hmm.
They just don't look like what you would think. You know, I've done
right.
Crypticons and Comic-Cons and this and that, where you're in such a crowd with such a group of other people all vying for the same thing that yeah. it's hard to be heard. It's hard to be seen.
Yeah.
But you, at an antique mall.
I know. But you know, I have to give credit. It's part of the genius of the owner of the mall.
It is. I got to grant him. It's a nice.
Yeah.
It's a nice
setup. He foreseen and he curates this mall. He invites artists. He wants all walks of life to come through and find something. So he's got, you know, he's got vendors that he's handpicking that are from mid-century to African art to
yes.
early American. It's just amazing. And it's not this giant warehouse of a mall, but there's so much in there and so much to see. And I have to say, and thanks to him, I'm very proud of being in there and,
oh, yeah.
and having my stage. He's given me an audience I didn't think was there. And I'm learning a lot about how not to judge a book by its cover.
It is surprising. Yeah. It kind of makes you go, okay, I got to adjust my view here.
Yeah.
Well, since we're talking on an audio medium here, you know, we can't show pictures in this podcast. Now yeah. I will put up some pictures that I've taken on my phone.
Yeah.
I'll put those up on the Facebook page
cool.
for Sideways Boulevard. However, and I hate to do this because I'm not real fond of when people say, well, who are your books like?
Yeah.
You mean Stephen King, all right?
Right, yeah.
I don't know. But I'm going to ask you to, if you can describe or know of any artists who you think have a similar flavor and tone. Because you're not on the frickin' web,
right,
John.
Right, right.
Nobody can find you, John. They'll be looking for my pictures for John Kelly. What the hell?
That's part of the dark mystery. And
that's part of the John Kelly mystique, Mark. Shut up.
The darkness. Yeah.
I live in the shadows.
Yeah. Well, word of mouth has always been good for me. And if I had to pay attention to checking the emails and sending things out, I don't even deliver my art. Or anything. I was in a couple galleries out of town. One was in Florida and stuff. It's a lot of work. and a lot of time to manage that kind of technology.
Oh, yeah.
When I appreciate all it can do and the tool that it is, but I wouldn't be creating all that I'm creating. There wouldn't be time for that, I feel. And it would stifle me because I would be worried about this getting out or responding to this and taking on loads of things that I don't even know anything about because I've never been part of that world. I've never owned a computer in my life. And just got a flip phone 2 years ago.
I know. When we were talking, I'm like, well, I can send you directions here to record the podcast. Wait, do you have a smartphone? No, it's a flip phone. Oh, my God.
He had to write it down, guys. He had to write it down.
He had to read my handwriting. There was pain on both sides, baby.
totally old world here. But to try to pinpoint it, it's like, being that artist who likes different kinds of medium, my art probably can be related to several different artists, from Tim Burton to Edward Gorey. Things like that. You know, the from dark humor to very serious kind of things, or mythical or fantasy art.
For example, on the outside, other side of your booth, you've got your version of goth Mary Poppins that does have that Tim Burton feel to it. It's beautiful.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
And then you go into the booth itself, and there were two that gave me such a Poe vibe, because one's a wider landscape mm-hmm. that has kind of the dark trees, and it's in mm-hmm. blues and blacks and some various other colors. Yeah. And I think there's a crow in that one.
Yes, there's a raven in that, overlooking a foggy lake with dead limbs coming up out of the fog. Oh,
it's just so good.
Well, thanks.
And then next to that one is more of just the trees, etc., but still kind of the same vein. Then we go to the left, and that was the one I took a little bit of a video of. And that's actually up. That's on my personal page, personal Facebook page, because I was just like, this is the coolest shit ever.
I'm honored.
And you had that little light that you attached to it. And tell me about what brought that picture about. Describe the one that I'm talking about that had the light on it. And then how it suddenly looks like it's actually on fire.
Yes. The ones you were describing are very say how different they can be, but still of dark nature. The one with the raven is very centralized. It's very minimal.
Yeah.
And it has a feeling to it where it's very calm and serene, but dark and beautiful.
Yeah.
The one that looks like it's on fire because I put a moving light on it. But if you take that moving light off of it, it still has a sense of feeling to it because I really paid attention to getting these flames to look very realistic, but also like you can almost hear them crackle. And what the scene is, I think there's four different spires, cathedral spires. So it's cathedrals burning. And all of that came from, and I've drawn several different burning cathedrals where maybe just one church, and down the hillside or cliff there's a low-lying cemetery in one of them. Another one is a gargoyle in the forefront with overlooking several pieces of architecture that are Gothic burning in the distance, which is one I created there also in my booth and had sold there once I got it in the frame. But every time I draw one of these burning cathedrals, they seem to sell really well and quickly. And so I call them my hot sellers. But anyway, how that came about, though, when I started drawing these, and this is touching on how I can find beauty in dark things, is because when Notre Dame caught fire and I was watching it unfold on television. And it was heartbreaking to me because I've never been to Europe, had not seen any of these beautiful historic pieces of architecture. And Gothic being one of my favorites, it really got to me. And, a bit of tear in my eye that I'll never experience that how it was originally built or being built. And, you know, a cathedral's never done. But in its tragedy, before that middle spire fell, and you could see the skeletal of it, and all of it was black and silhouetted in the rooftop of that cathedral. And as it was collapsing and the flames, and I saw the light of that moving light and the warmth against that silhouette. And it clicked. I was like, even in its tragedy, there's beauty.
Yeah.
And onward too, as things progress them wanting to recreate and bring it back to its fullness and stuff like that. There's beauty in that. There's togetherness in that and everything as artists and preserving and conserving and rebuilding and things like that. A renewal, you know, death and life. But so I started drawing these, and not to think that I was going to sell one. I have the first one I've drawn in my home. But yeah. I think even the people I wouldn't have thought, like, you know, we judge books by their covers a lot. I admit that too. But there's people that I wouldn't have thought would take a second look at it. And they do. And they want to know what brought that on. And when I tell them that, well, this is how it got inspired, they seem to let their guard down because they don't know which way to go, because it looks very sacrilege and, you know.
Yeah. Are you hating? Swing.
Yeah.
It's like, things no, like actually, that. No. I love this. It's beautiful.
It isn't that at all. And so when they realize that, they start seeing something they never thought, you know, they'd like or see or something like that. It's really an amazing thing. It's almost magical in those conversations. I just really love it.
Well, then with different forms of art that are on this dark side, there are some, we were chatting a little bit before we started recording the podcast, like I had mentioned, what was the name of that one? It's Saturn Devouring His Son from Francisco Goya from 1819. Pretty famous piece of dark art.
Yes, one of my favorite artists.
but it's really not, I don't think it's beautiful.
Right.
I can see some skill in the work on it, but overall I'm just like,
it's a bit gore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in your opinion, as an artist and as one who makes this type of art, not Goya's, mind you, what do you think is the factor that changes it from being like gore or just shock factor into beauty?
I think, again, it depends on the individual looking at it.
Beauty obviously is always in the eye. But
yes, exactly. But also, you have to take in, that's why it's important to be educated about art or what you're looking at. Don't just take it like a book by its cover.
Yeah.
Because there is beauty in that painting because of all the factors, the subject matter, how it became, the artist himself. And when you take all these things in, and when you're looking at something and then you're honing in because it's something very specific, this one painting. Now, other things that he does, you might think, oh, wow, yeah, I see that. Oh, that's beautiful, even though it's dark and he creates crazy creatures and things like that. But you can find it. If you look at it and you understand and you educate yourself about why it was drawn by this artist, the meaning behind it, and then look at the paint, look at the technique, look at the brush strokes.
Yeah.
The light is the first thing that comes to my mind when you bring that specific piece up. I love the way he painted the light. And it's interesting. And there's this other artist. He's a photographer. I don't know much about him. Someone was talking to me about this artist, and I may get this wrong, but I think his last name's Mortison. But he is all about dark art, and his pieces are very centralized. And so he tries to educate the viewer at first, what draws you to the painting? or the photography or whatever you're looking at. And we look at shapes at first. We look at how our eye is moved around the canvas. Mm-hmm. Things like that are involved in all this looking at art. And he is the master at drawing you in and making you look at the art, even though it's dark and it may not be something you would like. Like, say it was something my grandmother would never think of looking at or enjoying as art, but you can't help but look at it. There's something about his work, and he is very conscious of it. He knows why he's making what he's making, or photographing, or posing, and stuff like that. So, yeah, you got to look at all that too. And there's a lot of movement in that painting that you just see as grotesque, and I don't see the beauty in that. But there's things to find in it. Yes. There's things to learn about it, and learning and educating yourself about art is beauty. It is wonderful.
Well, you know, I make fun of that Francisco Goya one because I'm not real fond of it. However,
right.
that splash of blood is shocking.
Yes.
Because everything else is so muted.
Yeah,
and then you've got that bright red right at the neck and drizzling, and you're like, oh, damn.
Yeah.
So it gets a point. And the shocking value of Saturn eating his own son. So all that came together. There was that one, and I had to write this down. I couldn't have told you the name of it. I've been like, it was a screen thing. You used Japanese and a big old skeleton and like a samurai dude. And it was actually Takeyasha and the Witch and the Skeleton Specter. Takeyasha the Witch and the Skeleton Specter. It's from the year 939, and it's been on T-shirts, etc. It's like this big skeleton thing looming over this kind of a samurai-looking dude who's just getting ready to draw his sword and fight. And it's just beautiful, but again, it's kind of dark and spooky, but the colors and just the stylized positioning are amazing. One of the ones that I also loved that I've loved for years, I'm rather fond of the pre-Raphaelite artists. There's Waterhouse, and I know there's other ones, but I'm like, Waterhouse, I like Waterhouse. Very good. But there are so many of them that are almost painful looking at them because in a similar vein to the Mona Lisa and that, what the hell's going on in that head?
Right.
Because you've got this look that's
slightly off.
The faces and the emotions that are often held. I didn't even realize there was one I thought was so beautiful until I found out the story behind it. And hell, I just forgot the name of it. She's in a boat holding a lantern and has this super expectant look on her face as she's waiting in this little boat. Oh, it's stunningly beautiful until you realize, okay, the real story behind it is she's waiting for her love to arrive, and he doesn't because he was just killed in war, so she goes and, drowns herself. And you're like, fuck! Wow. No! You mean this ends? This expected look? And there are little hints in it, like a candle that's the flame is sideways. It looks like it's just about to be blown out.
Yeah, subtle
meanings. And you're like, oh my God, so well done. The one that I'm leading up to is called Sappho, by Charles Auguste Mengen from 1877. And in this one, it's based upon the story of Sappho, who, if I remember right, and I'm probably going to F this up, so, don't write angry letters to me or emails. Angry letters can go to John. He doesn't have email. You send them all to John Kelly.
Yeah, just send them to my email.
1313 is the booth.
Stop.
Remember when that Mark guy talked to you? He's an idiot. You're stupid for talking to him.
Great.
But Sappho is this beautiful painting, a woman standing there topless. It looks like she's holding, I believe, a harp. And this just her hang head look staring at the viewer.
Hmm.
She's staring right at you. But it's not sexy. It's painful. That look on her face, there's something really hard going on in there. And then you realize the story about Sappho and how she, if I remember right, again, hate me if you must, that her unrequited love, she flung herself off that cliff that's right there at the edge of that painting. And you're like, oh my God, this is so dark and beautiful.
And beautiful.
So I love what you do. Oh, before we move on and then move out, I did want to touch on that one other painting that you did. The one that stopped both my wife and I when we first met. It was just that face, that kind of yes. Greco-Roman black background. And if I describe it, I'm going to F it up and it's going to sound
You drew a face. It was real pretty.
No, describe the one that I'm talking about.
Okay. It's very Romanesque or very classical.
Yes.
Let's just say that. It's very classical features. It's a woman's face out of the shadows. It's very centralized. And it looks very aged, even though it's not. I did it all with charcoal pastels and added all the little fine cracks and lines as if it was stone or either the paint is cracking or something at all.
What were the colors that you used, the chalk colors, the main colors,
the pastels? The only color I used was black. The board in which I drew on is matte board that you mat in framing. The border around an art piece. I like drawing chalk on those because it picks up the chalk and you get texture, or you can really work it in and get a smoothness. I left texture around that in the background, but very dark, and then did real fine lines on her face and everything.
So, and her face is kind of golden.
That's the color of the board.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So it's almost like a reverse painting.
Negative space.
Yeah. Holy cow. Uh-huh. I didn't even know that. That just made it more impressive. I had no freaking idea. You hid that from me, you bastard, and waited to spring it on my ear. So I go, oh my God.
There you go. So yeah, it happened all in one day. The further description on this is, it's like very centralized face. There's no neck. It's just like a floating head, and it has a shroud over her head, with folds of fabric. And then her eyes are empty. They're just dark, and there's a bit of staining as if dark tears coming from the vacant eyes. And the lips are emotionless. There's no smile, no frown. It's just kind of stark. But it's the eyes that makes it tragic looking and saddened. And I just started drawing this on my 40th birthday. And it happened all in one day. I got it for the size that it is, the piece, even though I just used one piece of chalk, it got done in one day.
Wow.
And the mystery of it, as I was almost finishing it, I thought, well, what am I going to title this? This is something's with this picture. I don't know why. And the first name that popped into my head was Sarah. I don't know any Sarahs. None of my friends are named Sarah. I didn't know any Sarahs in high school. It was just a name that came out of the blue, and I didn't fight it. I thought, it's not a name if I had a daughter or something, I'd name her Sarah. Mm-hmm. I'm not particularly fond of that name. But I thought, John, since it's the first one that hit your head, go ahead and stick with it.
Yeah.
There's a reason. And you may not know it now, and I still don't. But also, as the evening went on and before I went to bed that night, I thought, what is it about this thing? And it hit me. I thought, this is, if my creative muse could materialize, this is what she would look like. Gothic and tragic. And it said everything right then. I was like, that's why it got done at a pivotal moment. We all reach our 40th birthday and it seems pivotal. It seems like, oh, this is the mark. But I had nothing planned that day. It wasn't like a big birthday celebration day or anything like that, but it was a 40th birthday thing. I don't know. It was weird how it came to be. but I'll probably never sell the original.
I was about to say, didn't you get an offer?
Yes.
Tell us about that guy that looked at it and was like, tried to talk you out of it.
Well, that's the thing about her too, about Sarah, is so many people are attracted to her, and which I find just totally, I feel proud and that people are seeing something in it. They'll want to know something about her or why, or they'll see something spiritual about it or something. But so it's not just me. But when I first showed her, I had her, it was in the River Market. I have a loft down there, and I still have that loft. But I would go down on the sidewalk, and I would take some drawings, and I would draw down there with an easel, and I'd put some out on the building. I wasn't particularly selling anything at that point. I just did it for myself, and I was curious to what people would like. I had some nature drawings because I love animals and things like that. And then I had her hanging there. Well, this older gentleman came by, and he was with his daughter, and he kept staring at it, and I kept drawing, and my back was kind of to him. And then he finally spoke, and he just simply asked, "How much is this one?" And I said,
How much for the girls? You're little girls. We want to buy your daughters. Right.
And I said, "Well, that one, I'm sorry, it's not for sale, but I'm glad you like it." And then he didn't say anything for a while. And then he said, "I have to tell you something." He said, "I came down here to buy fruits and vegetables. I wasn't looking for art or anything like that." He says, "There's something about this piece." Uh-huh. He says, "I wish you were selling it, because I don't care what it would be. I would want to buy this." And he said, "Let me give you a little background. I'll tell you what I do for a living. I work for the Nelson Art Gallery."
Oh my God.
"Curating the lighting for these paintings in the gallery." He would set the lights, and he knew how to light those paintings. He says, "I've seen so many paintings," and it feels like, I feel embarrassed talking about it, like I'm bragging.
No, it's awesome. It's freaking awesome.
It felt really good that it was coming from him, and it just proved to me there was something about this picture. But he said, "I've seen so many paintings and stuff." He says, "There's something about this one." He says, "It's not like any others I've seen." And I was like, wow, this is so weird. It was amazing.
Besides how cool your place was when we first walked by, it was the thing, the one that really made me stop.
Oh,
because you had that larger framed print of it, which was for sale.
Yeah.
And then you have, right now you have some smaller prints that are available in the booth.
I've got one left.
And I have some pictures of it that you can find on the Facebook page for Sideways Boulevard. This is the hard part, because we're gonna wrap it up, and you don't have any place I can send anyone on the web to find you.
Well, that means they have to come there and experience in real time, in real life.
Yeah, it's at the Metcalf Antique Mall, 9148 Metcalf Avenue, Overland Park, Kansas. By the way, while you're there, they've got some great clocks on the walls. They've
got this
crazy amount of cool looking clocks, and there's that big giant beaver.
Oh gosh.
Yes. There's a giant albino beaver that you can buy.
Yeah.
If you've been looking for a giant albino beaver, we got the hookup. And it's at Metcalf Antique Mall, 9148 Metcalf Avenue in Overland Park, Kansas. It's in the Regency Park Shopping Center. By the way, just around the corner, or just like a storefront down, is a super cool game place. So if you want to go look at some beautiful dark art and some cool antiques, and then head on over and grab yourself a game, do it. Monday through Saturday, 10 to 8 is when Metcalf Antique Mall is open. Sunday, 10 to 6. Now, how often are you there, John, in booth 1313?
Oh, my gosh. Almost every day. Since September, I just took the last 2 days off. That would make 9 days off since the beginning of September.
Oh, good Lord.
Yeah. I love being in that space.
I was about to say, it's not just work.
It's
your creative space.
It's food for soul. Yeah.
So are you painting dark art of people that come up there, like chunky, over-talkative, hairy dudes who...
No,
am I going to be in one of your artworks here, John?
Some people think they're interrupting me, like if I'm at the easel or I'm cutting out images or making assemblage pieces or whatever I'm working on. I deliberately place myself there so that, yeah, if someone wants to talk about art, talk about the dark art, I love it. I love it.
We're going to hit on a couple of other things and then honest to God, wrap it up. because I'm like, God, I'm keeping here forever and he needs to eat.
I got to create some more, Mark. You can't keep me all night.
You can't keep me down, Mr. Man.
At night's my most creative moment to create something. Yeah.
You've got the paintings that we talked about and the prints of the paintings. But mm-hmm. there's so much more. Hit on a couple of the other things that you have there, that your creations.
Yeah, I like doing assemblage pieces. So I'll take found objects and put them together in such a way to create dark art. Yeah. So sometimes I'll take like mantle clocks, antique mantle clocks that don't work anymore. And sometimes they don't even have their guts in them. But
is that the one with the skull in it?
Yes. Okay. There's one like that I turned into a wishing box. That is a skeleton, and it's only like from the mid area up, from his rib cage up, and he's inside this round porthole of a mantle clock. It's an iron mantle clock box. And the skeleton's hands are up close to his neck, and they're kind of folded out. And I made little parchments and scrolls and stuck in his hand. At the top of a clock, I took a half of a set of a salt and pepper shaker, which would have made praying hands if you put the salt and pepper shaker.
Oh, yeah.
And I only had one side of that set. And so I placed it on top of the box and painted it patina colors, uh-huh. the same as the clock,
oh,
the antique clock. And so I got this idea as I was creating it. To take the scroll, you unroll the scroll, take it from his hands, and write your wish on there. Roll it back up. Take the stopper out of the salt shaker, which is now part of the sculpture. Slip it in there and close it up, and the spirit of the box will grant your wish.
Oh, that's awesome. I didn't know the whole backstory behind it. I'm just like, this is a cool-looking thing.
Yeah. It's fun, creepy, crusty-looking old thing, and it looks like it's 100 or so years
old. It does.
But a lot of my assemblage pieces like that, I like putting either moving parts or there's a meaning, it has a function or something. It's not just decorative.
Yeah.
And so I've done a couple of mantle clocks where I've taken one of my original drawings, had a print made. By the way, I use ImageQuest, who does archival work for the Nelson Art Gallery.
Oh, wow.
And so when they make my prints of my original works, they are tip-top right on. Their work is incredible. So anyway, a little plug there for ImageQuest. Yeah, shout out to ImageQuest.
Not exactly infographics, but close.
But anyway, so they made me a print of this original that I did. It was called Invocation. And it sold before I got it done off the easel.
Wow.
And it's done in chalk, and it's a nighttime wooded scene. And in the foreground of these trees is a bonfire with three goats dancing upright around the fire. And then way off to the left, way back into the trees, you see just a hot spot of light of another bonfire going on. So it suggests that there's another little party going on further back into the woods. It's very pagan.
Yeah.
So, and beautiful that way. So a lot of my drawings do have a bit of that theme to it, a pagan kind of theme. But anyway.
Do you have goats playing cards at a card table?
No, not yet.
Damn it.
Not yet. But thank you. I might
get right on that. Yeah.
But my creative muse lets me. But so they made a smaller print for me. I asked them, can they make it downsize that? So I cut out the oval, the round part, the same size as the clock opening of one of the mantle clocks, and fitted it in there with the frame of the gilded gold that the face of the clock was on, and it has a swinging glass on it on the front. And so that framed the picture. and of just the goats dancing around the fire. Uh-huh. Then I took a flicker bulb, which you can get at any hardware store, and a work light, a drop light, bowl lamp, took the bowl off, did that. Now I have simply a cord and a bulb, and you can plug it in, and I attach it inside the clock so that you can turn it on like a night light. And it completely brought my work of art to life.
Brought it to life.
Yeah. And if you stare at it long enough, I'm not joking, it looks as though the goats are moving.
Moving. Oh,
but
my
gosh. The flames look really real. And they start very hot, warm, low to the bonfire. And then as they curl up, it turns into a green kind of fire. And it's just, I love that piece. And so nice. Now I'm not just selling the prints of the whole invocation piece. I'm creating
little experiential art pieces. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, almost assembly interactive.
Piece. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm working now real quick. I'll let you know it's coming up now. How fast it gets done, you know, depends on my creative muse again, but it's a grandfather clock and it's empty. And at the top of the clock where the face of the clock is, will be a goat figure, a bust of a goat in a vest, and he's very humanized. And in the background is sort of they were popular in the 50s where they had these mirrors that were round and they looked like sunbeams in gold coming out. It's a piece like that, which will float behind that with red fabric, crushed red velvet, all encased around that with a light in there. And then where the pendulum once swung, that glass front, I'm making with foam, very rocky and edgy and sharp edges of like cliffs with cubby holes. And I'm going to put little skulls into the cubby
hole. Oh my gosh.
And then there'll be these small skeletons that are plastic that I'm able to melt and contort, and they'll look burnt and everything, that will look as if they're trying to escape hell. And it'll have a moving flame light in that also. And so it'll look like brimstone. And then there'll be these sets, maybe two or three larger skeletons that I'll attach like bat wings to. And they'll have horns as if with spears, as if they are working it.
Yeah.
So a very hellish scene.
Oh, sure.
But with the moving light and everything, it'll become a night light. And for someone who really liked the dark subject.
That's really what I want, lighting my way down a dark hallway.
Exactly.
It's a little scene from hell.
Exactly.
That is awesome.
It makes you think.
That is awesome. You can find all those. And plus you've got some hanging art pieces that are like faces.
And
almost
the clay works.
Yeah, clay works, gargoyles. Mm-hmm. You've the standing pieces, you've got some memento mori there, which is really cool. Some photographs, et cetera, et cetera. It is a great place that if you like dark art, you can feel comfortable looking at it going, oh, cool. And you're not going to stand out like a sore thumb. So, cause that's what I did there for what, 2 hours?
Yeah.
The first time we were there. So, again, it's John Kelly. Look for booth 1313 in the Metcalf Antique Mall. And if you want to see some of the pictures that I took there, and I took it with my phone. I should have brought my 35mm because then at least they would have been a little fancier. But you will get an idea of just how cool and how big this presentation is. And then you can talk to John about his art and take some home. Because it's very cool and it's very available, and you can get it signed by the artist. Just FYI.
Thank you, Mark, very much.
You know, John, thank you for coming to visit with me here. I know it was so odd just the way everything clicked that day, and how much I enjoy the artwork and having other people, you know, being around other people who get what it is pleasant and comforting.
Yes.
And fun, because then you get to geek out about the cool shit that you can't talk to anybody else about. Who else can I go, oh man, I saw this thing and it was dead. And you're like, oh yeah. Can't usually do that in a lot of my regular conversations or my day job. So
it's hard to find kindred.
Yes.
And when you do, it's great. Yeah. Thank you, Mark.
Be sure to check out John Kelly's work on our Facebook page. Look for Sideways Boulevard on Facebook. I'll see if I can pop some up on Instagram also. And you can go to our regular Sideways Boulevard website, but oh my God, it's a hot mess. I am so over my head, and I'm going to be talking to friends who know how to do this type of stuff to help fix the disaster that I have created. And be sure to listen here and everywhere you find your favorite podcasts, and share it with your friends if you would, please. John, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Mark.
And we will see you down the road on Sideways Boulevard.
According to Ozark legend, someone who's been cursed by witchcraft can leave a black button lying on the road. If you should pick it up, you'll get more than you bargained for. You see, if you take the button, you also take the curse. Welcome to the Black Buttons Dark Fiction Anthology Series, published by Magnificent Cowlick Media and available on Amazon.com. All stories involve the tone and the terror of the Midwest. Turn the page in Black Buttons and discover that all is not right where the Bible Belt buckles. Black Buttons, Volume 1, Volume 2, and Volume 3, available now on Amazon.com. Go ahead, if you dare. Pick up Black Buttons, because you're not afraid of some old superstition, are you?
Are you?
At long last, I am able to say a few words of my own.
Never have you known such cringing terror.
I hear you talking.
I won't kid you. I like to do audio. Mark here, co-host of Pottenstein's Lab. My little company, Magnificent Cowlick Media, located right here in Kansas City, does audio. I write it, I mix it, I voice it, I love it. If you need help creating a more unique commercial, maybe a more creative approach to communication, I would love to help. Stop by magnificentcowlickmedia.com. Don't forget to look for it on amazon.com for all our books. And thank you so much for listening to Sideways Boulevard.